This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Manchester United win the Carabao Cup. In the end, a relatively straightforward win for Erik ten Hag's side. If Casemiro was a panic buy, sometimes it's quite good to panic. More proof he was being held back at the Bernabeu. The Loris Carrier story arc had neither a glorious or a tragic end. And so the overexcited Geordies in the Trafalgar Square fountain will have to wait for a bit more Saudi investment before ending their drought. In the Premier League, we've already done one emergency Chelsea manager podcast this season, and frankly, we don't have time to do one today. Graham Potter's side anemic once again, this time at Spurs. Arsenal and City both win at the top, while West Ham score four goals. Danny Ings knows where the goal is. A big first win for Javi Gracia, a big second defeat for Sean Dyche, and Liverpool still aren't quite at it. Also today, Celtic win the Scottish League Cup. We pay tribute to John Motson, and the pod finally reaches the North Pole. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nader Manuaha, welcome.
Good morning, sir. Good morning.
Dave says, starting the sweepstakes now for the first To Be Totally Honest of the pod. What are we saying? I'm going the 12th minute. Welcome, Troy Townsend.
To be totally honest, that's totally out of the question, that. So, yeah, good morning, by the way.
And Mark says, is Barry going to speak before 8 minutes, 50 seconds this time? It took me completely by surprise on Thursday. I'd forgotten he was on. Welcome, Barry.
Hello, Max. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Let's start with the Carabao Cup final then. Dave says, should be happy that the pre-nation state club beat the nation state club. Nadim, you were there, and you talk to us now from a windowless hotel room in Houston.
Yes.
Because as we've established before the pod, you're a frugal man.
Yes.
So obviously you've got nothing to see, nothing to take your attention away from the podcast. I didn't think that was a fascinating game of football myself.
Yeah, I know where you're coming from. And I think if you are linked to either of the football clubs, then obviously it's a huge storyline itself. But the nature of the game, it wasn't the most frenetic end-to-end thing, tons of chances and so on. And then also, this is the side of things which I find quite interesting. Before the match, I was speaking on a show and they were obviously, you know, this is my main show.
Thank you.
I spoke on another show somewhere out there. And they were making the point that Newcastle have got the stat for the smallest amount of time that the ball stays in play for during a match. And then they went 2-0 down and Man United did exactly to them what Newcastle allegedly have been doing to other teams. So I think for United, it's a big moment for them to be winning a trophy. But you could see from the fans, they were happy to do it, but you could see they've done it before. Whereas for the Newcastle fans, you had 30, 40,000 fans in the stadium and another 60,000 around London. That was such a big day for them. And in the game, they definitely had a goal, but you kind of sense based on the way that the weeks have gone recently that Newcastle being down was almost like, this is how it's going to finish. I think they needed to score first to sort of ask more questions of United, but instead, when United have got someone who can manage a game like a Casemiro and others, I think his stat is he's won 15 of his 16 finals. Like, get that guy in a final, you've got a lead, and you feel quite confident that you'll be able to get a result. But yeah, overall, it wasn't the best of games. But then for United, it doesn't need to be. It just needs to be enough to win a trophy, tick that off, and then go and get ready for the next one. And just like to give a special shout out to all those United fans that were throwing up two fingers at me, single fingers, everything. And it's great. It's great to see you here as Man United are back and City are something else. Yeah. So yeah, thank you to all those guys for making me feel so welcome. It was a fantastic day, one I'll remember forever.
Just out of curiosity, Nadim, were the Newcastle fans doing the same, given your Sunderland previous?
No. So because I was only there for a year, I think they've got like a light level of hatred for me. But because I played for City for so long and I still live in the city, like they're acutely aware of the fact that I wanted that game to finish in a draw and get it cancelled. So they definitely let me know. And the funniest one actually that I heard was there was a United fan who was shouting at me saying it was a conspiracy that let Man City win the title in 2012. He's saying you were a disgrace. You gave it to QPR. You gave the ball to City. They went and scored. You're a shambles. And I thought, oh, he's joking. But he's looking me dead in the eye, like 100% serious. Sorry, mate. I've just got to go and do some work. I'll be right back.
Sounds like we could do a 10-part podcast series on the conspiracy of Nadim handing the Aguero title to Manchester City. Troy Graham has asked a question. Is Casemiro the best steady Eddie in the world? That's sort of damning with faint praise for quite a talented footballer.
It's amazing how people have dismissed his time at Real Madrid almost as if he was a bit part towards all their many trophy laden seasons. Listen, he's the bit that has knitted everything together. I actually was at the game as well yesterday. You've totally ignored that, but don't worry, we'll put that into the pod as well. And I was in the Newcastle end, which was amazing, to be totally honest, until obviously Man United got the first one. And then, yeah, I think they kind of realised that it was, yeah, they weren't going to win. He's proven to be a defensive goal-scoring midfielder, which Roy Keane wasn't, was he? He's just unbelievable, to be totally honest. He's caught up to the speed of the Premier League immediately. He's doing bits in cup games. He's orchestrating the whole way that United play. And he is what he always was, has been an absolutely fantastic footballer, although people seem to only acknowledge the time that he's had at United.
It is different. I mean, he does seem, I didn't watch Real Madrid week in, week out, but he wasn't gallivanting. He wasn't like scoring headers from free kicks.
He didn't have to gallivant, but you know, yeah, maybe he's been unleashed now and maybe his true qualities are shining through, and it's exactly what United needed. But a Real Madrid without Casemiro at the time that he was playing for them maybe wouldn't have got over the line in many of those games. But yeah, he's going to be up for player of the season, no doubt, if Man United keep going the way they're going. I would imagine he would be in the 11 for the player of the year and maybe in the shortlist for player of the season as well. That's how good he's been over the period of time that he was here. But I just wanted to quickly say about Newcastle, who frustrated me no end. Maximum, who could have taken the ball by the horns yesterday, but seemed to always get to near the edge of the box. I don't know if you saw this, Nathan, but he got Dalot on a booking straight away. He then came up against Wan-Bissaka. And then he just kept, I don't know, it's like he ran out of ideas. And I don't know whether that's lack of match play or whatever else, but he seemed so exciting and then just ran out of ideas. And I think the biggest thing for Newcastle was Isak coming on and then, you know, playing just behind Callum Wilson, who doesn't look like he's got a goal in him at the moment, by the way, and doing very well to ignite them until Man United shored up again and started to create chances on the break.
I like the idea of Casemiro saying, look, don't have to gallivant. Happy to gallivant if you want me to. that's what I'm offering you. Barry, almost 8 minutes 50 in, we should come to you. What did you make of this affair?
It wasn't a particularly good game, and Manchester United didn't play brilliantly, but then they didn't have to, because I thought Newcastle offered very little. They barely laid a glove on them, really. They started quite well, and Alisson Maximin looked a threat early on, but in the second half, Aaron Wan-Bissaka completely had him in his pocket, and I think too many of Newcastle's big name players didn't deliver on the day. Bruno Guimaraes didn't play well. I expected a lot more for him. Callum Wilson was largely anonymous. Miguel Almiron didn't have a particularly good game. Sean Longstaff was taken off at halftime. I don't know if that was a tactical switch, but he offered nothing as well. And then when you look at their bench, Isak, obviously record signing, he made a difference, but they brought on Jacob Murphy, Joe Willock, Matt Ritchie, Elliot Anderson, and you'd wonder if any of those have a future under this, you know, new Newcastle regime. You'd imagine most of them will probably be shipped out during the summer. United were all right, but they didn't have to be anything better than all right, because there's no. Newcastle fans will obviously be disappointed they missed out on yet another opportunity to win a trophy. I think that's 5 finals in a row they've lost. But I'd be more disappointed in the manner of the defeat, which I thought was pretty... they were okay, but if they'd played above themselves, they could easily have won this game, I think.
Yeah. Max, timestamp this, yeah? This is going to happen. So I would like to say, put it on record, that I thought Man United defended really, really well yesterday. And the structure in which they do things is very impressive. I've got to say as well, I was in the sort of tunnel area afterwards, Lisandro Martinez, he isn't tall, but he's taller than I thought. Yeah. So I have to give him credit for that. And there was a point, I think, in the first half when he had a clash of heads with Cher. Like, that's a little man getting up there. That's aggression. For as much as he's not that tall, he's very committed. And defensively, because their attack wasn't really doing that much yesterday, defensively, they had to be solid. And even though Newcastle were coming at them, and they seemed like they were running out of ideas at times, they did stay very, very committed. They had a plan. And to throw in another compliment there, most managers would have done the, say, Harry Maguire on early thing, brought him on after like 60 minutes or whatever, but he kept it till right to the very end. And all the tactics they were making were still showing pressure to Newcastle should they think that it can just play out from the back. And when a team does that, I think that's a sign of actual class and ability. So in this moment, on this day, I will praise Man United because they didn't play that well, but they still managed the game where the other side was given everything to try and beat them. So I apologize to my City people there, but I said it and I stand by it because it was very impressive.
Well, it's a great chance for the City fans to stick two fingers or one finger up at you to get the full set. Andrew says, with Carrier starting for Newcastle, when was the last time you were genuinely nervous? Not for a team you support, but for a specific player before a game. I thought it was interesting, Troy, even with the camera work, right? Man United, whenever, you know, Man United scored two goals and the camera immediately went to Carrier, like to almost to try and create this story that we were waiting for. And look, you could argue that he might have done better with the second, but I think that's really harsh given the ball is actually going on the ground from Rashford and then it flicks up. There's nothing he can do about their header. Like, we were expecting a Hollywood story one way or the other, and it just didn't happen, did it?
Well, that's the stories that were created straight after Pope got sent off, wasn't it? And it was always going to be coming into the game that there was going to be this whole kind of thing around the goalkeeper of Newcastle and what he would do. Obviously, I didn't see the replays, but I was wondering how the second goal went in. I was right behind, I was a little bit higher up, and I was wondering how the second goal went in. I maybe this is a bit harsh. I still think he should do better. And there may be others that will say, because I think he was very low, and I get that. But the deflection wasn't, I don't think it was a massive deflection to that he couldn't adjust his body and you know, make a save there or get some fingertips on it. But again, I'm not a goalkeeping expert, and anyone that listens to this that is, that wants to tell me that I've never played in goal, so I don't know what it's like, I'm happy for that. But the story is always going to be around the goalkeeper. It was created last week from Pope sending off and everyone saying that, you know, he should be able to play in the final. I wasn't on that. The rules are the rules. You know, everyone knows it and the sympathy was there. But ultimately, Newcastle had to go in with a new goalkeeper. And listen, he made some routine saves. He wasn't under massive amount of pressure, like from set pieces or stuff like that. But United scored the goals in the manner that they did that won the game. And it's as simple as that, really. No real fault to Karius. But like I said, I think he may have done better on the second one.
I think he was under a massive amount of pressure, though, just going into the game. Like, and you could see there was one, I think the very first back pass he got, it looked briefly as if he was going to be stranded in no man's land. And, it, you know, you'd think, oh, my God, please don't let this happen to the poor guy. And then when Manchester United got their first corner, their players immediately surrounded him. And I thought, he played quite well. I wouldn't apportion blame to him for either goal. And it could have been an absolute disaster for him, given what happened in that Champions League final and what, you know, his lack of playing time since.
Meanwhile, Jim says, can you envision a world where Eddie Howe isn't Newcastle manager next season? Not just based on the final. They've been lacking for weeks. If that continues, they miss out on Europe. Could the owners decide they need a Tuchel or a Pochettino to push the club forward? What do you think, Baz?
I hadn't really thought of it, to be honest. Yeah, but it's a harsh business, isn't it? I think Eddie Howe will be fine as long as the supporters are happy with him. But the fact of the matter is Newcastle have dropped a level in recent weeks. The goals have kind of dried up. Performances are a bit flat. But I would be astonished if the fans were to turn on him. I think they love him at the moment, but fans can turn very quickly. And I think there is it entitlement the right word? A sense of entitlement among fans now because they have all this money. The squad does need a reboot. You know, there are a lot of bang average players in that squad who were fighting against relegation this time a year ago. Who I think will be shipped out, and it depends who comes in. I presume he'll be given the summer, but if they were to start next season and results were bad, yeah, I could definitely imagine him getting shown the door.
On the same subject, Nadim as how tall people are. Paul says, is Les Ferdinand the tallest 5'11" person ever? Himself and Roy Keane are the same height. Nothing has ever shocked me as much. You know, right, he was very good in the air, Les Ferdinand, wasn't he? Anyway, unless anyone else has anything vital to say about the Carabao Cup final, we can move on to the Premier League, and we'll do that in part two. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We'll do the top of the league in a second, but let's start at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Spurs 2, Chelsea 0. Mark says, might the wishes of the Chelsea fans come quicker than they anticipated with at the ESL protests. One of them had a banner in felt tip saying, we want our cold nights in Stoke. Gary says, how soon after you finished recording the pod will Chelsea announce Potter's dismissal? Another defeat for Chelsea. No goals in 5 games. Nadim, it was poor from Chelsea, wasn't it? And you look at that team on the pitch, you think they've got to be better than that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think even though, you know, we can say they don't have a number 9 and so on, they do still have enough players on the field that should be able to score goals and to create tons of chances. But for some reason, it's just not there at this moment. And I think some ways you look at confidence and the like, but they would fancy their chances of going and playing against Spurs. You know, Spurs are a good side, but they're not like this side who should, you know, have comfortable wins against anybody realistically in the league. But even though they are good, like they can win, but it's just, it's weird. I find it really hard to talk about a struggling Chelsea side that isn't delivering action, because for the last 20 years, anytime they even slightly struggle, action occurs and there's a new manager that comes in. But in the same breath with Graham Potter, I also don't want to see him sacked, because I think it's a very tough job that he's got at this moment in time. And I think some of the stuff which he said in the last week about receiving death threats and the like, I think that stuff is so, so poor. But then when they go out on the weekend and they don't win, before you know it, all those things just arrive again. I'd hate to be in his position. And obviously, you know, that's the only reason I'm not in management, because I don't want to be Graham Potter. You know what I mean? Simple as that, Max. But it's a tough situation that they're in. I don't know how it changes at the moment. Maybe they feel like they need a result to spark something. But then would I be surprised if they then lost the next game? Probably not. So I'd hold my hands up. I really don't know how to cover them at the minute, because everything should be working, but apparently nothing works and I can't see why.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't create... What did they create, Troy? There was that moment where I think Havertz came through and Forster came out quite quickly. And it's interesting, at that Dortmund game a week and a half ago, I thought they played really well and I thought they were really unlucky. And then Southampton, they weren't good. And then you look at Graham Potter bringing on Aubameyang, you know, and as he's stripping off, Spurs scored basically the game that clinches it. You think, that looks like you're starting to panic now. Yeah.
His starting 11s, I don't know if he's... Someone might be able to tell me. Has he played the same starting 11 for two games on the spin? He's making multiple changes. And for me...
I think it's 73 changes. I think, and I might be wrong, wow. But I think we did the team news yesterday, didn't we, on the radio, Barry? The reporter at the ground said, yeah, he's made 73 changes since he got there. Not in just the last game. That would be quite... a lot in but yeah.
It looks like a manager that's searching for a formula that is not within his squad. And you've got to remember, we all know they've made massive amount of signings, whether they're Graham Potter signings or not. He has now the players that should be able to get results. The one thing he's brought with him from Brighton is the fact that they can't score goals. They've gone from a team that very free-flowing before, all right, They were, you know, under Tuchel near the end, they were being questioned, but they're not even creating much, which has to be a massive worry. And the permutations that he puts together for his team to go out and play, I've questioned it quite a bit. And look, we're right. No one deserves to receive that amount of hate and threats, which must worry him every single match day anyway, by the way. I don't think we as fans or you know, commentators or pundits appreciate that, to be totally honest. But it's one win in 11. It's four goals scored. It's very hard to kind of describe what is going wrong with the amount of players that they have to make the team look good. You look at Felix, he looks a good buy, but he's actually not there, so they're going to have to try and purchase him. Obviously, Thiago Silva came off yesterday, and for me, he's, again, I've been criticised for this quite a lot, particularly on the London Football Awards panel. I still think he's one of the best centre-backs we have in the league, and has performed to that level every single time. But you take him out of the equation and they look really unorganised. It's the first game Chilwell and James had played together in quite a long time as well. That, listen, he's the puppet master. He should be the guy that knits them all together, but there's something drastically wrong. And despite the kind of backing that he has, this can't continue for Chelsea. It cannot continue in this vein.
Yeah, I think it's the problem might be that he has too many players at his disposal. It's kind of like when you get Netflix for the first time. I remember I was just overwhelmed by all this choice. You know, where do I start? There's too much stuff here that I want to watch or that I could.
You can't just go, oh, Mudrick is trending. I'll just try that. That's number one in the UK. I'll just try that.
Yeah, and then you quickly realise that probably 70% of it is total shite that isn't worth watching. So you just sort of, well, and then start to work your way through what is good. And I think it might be like that. He's just looking at this bloated squad with all these very good players going, oh God, I have to, you know, whittle this down to 18 on a match day or whatever. And yeah, it's, but like as Troy says, it can't go on. You wonder, I mean, I think you should have that voice note recorded and on standby because I keep expecting, you know, it to happen and for Todd Bowley to pull the trigger. He can't be happy with what he's seeing because the stats are so damning.
Yeah,
and there's no doubt Potter is a good manager. We've seen that at Brighton, but I would love, I suppose much depends on what the players think of him and what the mood is in the dressing room. Is it mutinous? Is it not? If it is mutinous, then, you know, he's got to go, you think.
Yeah, and actually that's an interesting question for Nadim, right? When he got the job, a lot of people said, look, he doesn't arrive at this club with trophies and medals on his CV. There are big players there who do have that and there are big egos there. So will they accept him? You know, is there a possibility that they just won't ever have accepted that, you know, he'll do a meeting and then they'll all just get on WhatsApp afterwards going, I'm not having this.
You kind of said that like, you know, I've experienced that before. obviously, when he arrives, doesn't necessarily have the same history as other managers that tend to arrive at Chelsea. But then there have been other managers who arrived at Chelsea who've got all the accolades. And other clubs, actually, they have all the accolades, but then they're not successful either. I think at the end of the day, for me, it comes down to what you do on the training pitch, how you set the team up, and can you find that little bit extra in terms of motivating them to go and be successful? Because the margins between yourself and any other team in the Premier League, they're not so great to the point whereby any result should be expected. And mate, they are struggling, but what I would say, like, regardless of whatever the manager's doing, like yesterday, he puts out a team who's got two fullbacks who love to get forward. They've got four players up front who love to score goals. They've got Loftus-Cheek who wants to participate as well. Enzo Fernandez who wants to be front foot. They have a lot of attacking talent out there, yet still they're not scoring goals. And you could say, well, maybe it's because they don't respect the manager. But I tell you what, they'll probably love the idea of scoring goals in a game and winning, because the feeling of losing and just not winning games itself is awful, especially for those players who are as good as they are. They won't. Most of those won't be used to going on runs like this for most. I imagine it's the first time they've ever been on a run like that. Obviously, speaking from experience, I've had quite a few, but it's tough. but yeah, for them, I don't think it's a case of not respecting the manager. I think something is missing. Some of the players are out of form. But from the moment the manager sends the players across that white line, what you can tweak a formation, you can give information, but then they still need to put the ball back into the goal. And he can't step in there and separate the defenders for them and say, here you go, here's an empty net. So I don't know what's missing. And it'd be interesting to see what the players do think of him. But I don't think he's done anything that would make me think the players have basically sacked him off just because he doesn't have a history of winning trophies, because at the end of the day, he's the man in charge and he's probably doing stuff that's good, because otherwise he wouldn't be in that situation.
And he says, are Spurs good again? Brackets, please say yes. Troy, Oliver Skip, his first goal for Spurs, looks about 40, no discernible great attributes, but possibly like a deceptively good footballer.
Did you say looks about 40? Anyway.
Well, he does, doesn't he? He looks, when someone said, I think he's 22, and you were just like, come on, he can't be 22.
Listen, he's doing a job. I think there was massive concerns, obviously, when the two players in Central Park got injured, Bentancur, obviously, massively. Not so much Bissouma, but he's the replacement. But he stepped in, and Skip is one of those steady players, isn't he? He'll give you the same kind of every week. He'll go unnoticed. Spurs have had a few of those come through the academy, but they do a job. And, you know, yesterday he stepped up, and what a cracking finish for his first goal.
I should say Oliver Skip was interviewed after the game. Seemed like a lovely man. I wasn't trying to be, just in case he's a massive fan of the pod. I'm a massive, massive fan of yours. As someone who looks incredibly old. I mean, to be fair, Oliver, I am incredibly old. I'm double your age. Zach says,
he's walking it back. Boo. Shame on you.
I've seen players improve with competition many times. I've never seen them doing it seemingly overnight like Emerson Royale has. Some other examples of underperforming players turning around their form with the introduction of competition. Yeah, he's looked really brilliant since Pedro Porro turned up. There was also, Barry, this sort of bizarre VAR incident at the end of the first half where Ziyech was sent off. But I think it was the right decision. I don't think that was a red card, was it?
Absolutely not. They got to the right decision. It took a while and they seemed to go in it in an order that was somewhat arse about it. You would expect Stuart Atwell to look at the monitor before showing the red. He didn't. I don't know why. But yeah, they got the right decision in the end. It did seem to knock the stuffing out of everyone. You know, the crowd, I think, had no idea what was going on. I didn't really have much of a clue what was going on. But it would have been very harsh for Ziyech to get a red for that cuff.
At the King Power, Leicester 0, Arsenal 1. Nadine, this was a very comfortable 1-0, I thought, for Arsenal.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was watching this game for some show. Again, I'm sorry, I do other shows. But I was watching the game, and for Arsenal, they limited Leicester at home to having one shot, and that was from 25 yards out from Dewsbury Hall. And you think to yourself, that's so impressive. I think the way that they would keep possession, the chances they created, obviously they didn't score more than the one on the day, but it was a good goal in itself. And with a sort of variant of not having Nketiah playing up there, with the three sort of like smaller forwards. And I was very impressed. They're so good at attacking, but one thing that sort of makes them really good is the way they can sustain attacks. Not many teams can keep good possession in the opposition's half, but they really do ring right behind where the ball is. So when you think you've cleared it, before you know it, Arsenal are coming again. And it's a very, very impressive performance. They feel like they're back in that sort of groove again. And I've reached a point where I don't know. Well, no, I'll tell a lie. I don't know anyway. I was going to say, I don't know when I'll see them dropping points, but it's football, it's the Premier League, anything could happen. But they're very much in a good spot. It seems like the good feeling is back after having a bad 10 days. You know, some people called it a crisis, but now all of a sudden they're back to the top of the league, 5 points ahead of Man City, 8 points ahead of Man United. And yeah, very much in control of their own destiny. So it was very, very impressive because, as I say, to limit a side like Leicester just one shot, obviously they didn't have Maddison, but to limit them to one shot is some going.
Yeah, you talked about restricting them. Akers says, I know how you guys love an XG discussion. I noticed that Leicester mustered cumulative 0.01 XG today. How bad does a chance have to be to register 0.01? Was the shot from the moon? Surely a goal kick could catch a gust of wind and be at least 0.02. Guy says, was Lee Mason on VAR at Leicester? Yeah, we wondered yesterday, Barry, if that was his leaving present to be the VAR. And interestingly, and I'll come to you, Troy, on this, about the difference in how much Ben White was fouling Danny Ward for that goal that was disallowed, eventually that brilliant goal by Trossard, compared to how much Harry Suter was it Bukayo Saka he was dragging down? How much of a foul that was? I mean, like, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, apart from, of course, Nadim throwing the 2012 Premier League. But really, if I was an Arsenal fan, I'd start to think this is getting a bit odd now, isn't it?
I think I'm going to upset a few here. I thought it was a foul on Ward. It doesn't matter how much of a foul it is. He's the goalkeeper. White has locked his arm, so he can't, you know, he can't punch with two arms. He's had to punch with one. It's a great finish from Trossard, and I'd love him to have had that, because he's been an exceptional signing already for the club. But I think it's a foul.
Yeah, I suppose you can't hold the goalkeeper's hand. It does seem
well in the grand scheme of things. That's for me. Yeah, but I also, you're right, I also think it's a pen, and those are the kind of situations for me that the referees have to get tougher on. Because it's one of those, if it's anywhere around the pitch outside the box, I think he gets a free kick. So I don't know what that communication is that says, well, it wasn't enough of a. I hear that quite a lot. It wasn't enough of a. But it for me, it's a penalty. And again, when you're able to get multiple views, we talk about clear and obvious. I don't know what clear and obvious means when VAR comes into play. But for me, that's a penalty. So I think they got the first one right. It's nothing against my the way that I perceive Arsenal, but I thought they got the Saka one wrong. But like Nadim says, I thought it was a very, very mature performance from Arsenal. And I like the fact that Arteta utilised Trossard and Martinelli in the way that he did. I thought Nketiah needed a break. He's been so good for so long. But it's almost like he needed a break, and those two were perfect for that game, and it's a great win for Arsenal. Great win.
I think any other player, if it's anywhere around the pitch outside the box, gets a free kick. Saka, no, he doesn't get free kicks.
that's
anywhere.
That's the conspiracy. I wanted to come to you, Barry, with one of those questions, which is Harry Suter is big, isn't he? I mean, we talked about deceptively big players. What about actually big players? I mean, it's almost like Trossard could have nutmegged him and then just run through his legs afterwards.
Yeah, it's not a great look when you're that tall and you get nutmegged like that. And I think Suter has played quite well for Leicester since joining, albeit having, I think, scored an own goal in his opening game and then wrestling Saka to the ground there and being lucky not to concede a penalty and getting nutmegged. But yeah, it was unfortunate. It doesn't look great, but I don't think there's a huge amount he could do about it.
I mean, he can't be smaller for that game. We can't look at the opposition and go, oh, they're playing Trossard false nine. I'll just put my boots on the end of my knees and just sort of waddle about. City kept the pace up. They won 4-1 at Bournemouth. Nadim, quite an expected result, you know, in terms of XR. You know,
XR.
It was just very straightforward, wasn't it? It's quite hard to analyse it any more than that, apart from Phil Foden was good.
Yeah, Phil Foden was good. And I think that's going to be a big deal for City going forward, because I think for the previous 2 months or so, he'd either been out of the team or not playing too well. But for them to have that competition for places again, up in those forward areas, I think it'll probably bring out the best. Kind of like we're seeing with Emerson Royale, who knows? Maybe the next time someone plays, the next guy will be incredible. But yeah, it was expected. And boom, if you can see, they've just run out of whatever it was that they had for that little period. They're very much struggling. If this is the way that results will go at home, just imagine when they go on their travels. So fair play to City. They got the result. They needed to do it. I think some Arsenal fans would have been hoping for something bad to happen, but miracles don't always happen. And for City, it was pretty routine. They're getting in a groove. Players got a chance to play who hadn't played for a little while. And yeah, the chase is well and truly on still.
I think that little period for Bournemouth was a game, if I'm remembering correctly, but you know, still counts, I guess, as a little period.
They've got Arsenal and Liverpool next up, I think, so it's looking bleak for Bournemouth.
Yeah, we have said that before, haven't we? I mean, it's so tight at the bottom. We can do West Ham Forest 4-0, four goals in 20 minutes. Feels, Troy, unlikely for West Ham to ever score four goals in 20 minutes. I mean, I don't know if I'm laying the blame there at Nottingham Forest to achieve something actually quite spectacular by allowing West Ham to score four times in such a short period of time.
Well, when you've got a forward like Danny Ings who smells goals from everywhere, doesn't he? And I think, listen, David Moyes is under pressure, and it's the second time that he's been under pressure, and they've produced a really, really good result, the first being Everton. So there were rumours during the week again that he's, you know, likely to be replaced if they didn't get a result this time. And it's almost like the players turned up for him again. It was almost like this was going to be a game that they were never going to lose because they wanted to keep their manager, unlike Chelsea's performances. And Danny Ings was the difference to start with. You know, he scored two brilliant goals, poacher's goals, you know, created the first one himself and didn't just admire his crossfield pass, I think, to Jared Bowen. He made sure that he was on the end of the ball when Bowen put it in a very, very good position. The second one, same, a little poacher's goal. Great work on the wing by Benrahma. And then Declan Rice, who's recently been criticised for not contributing with enough goals, scores an absolute beauty. So, lot of goals in a short space of time. Forest had put, obviously, they've had a good run and it should never be taken away from them what Cooper has done there since he signed his contract when everyone thought he was getting the sack. But their away form is not great. And I think I saw a stat where they'd only scored 3 goals away from home. So maybe it was a time that they were going to kind of cave in almost. And this was the game. And I'm sure Antonio will be pleased because he hasn't been scoring goals when he's been starting. So coming on and getting one as well was massive for him. The Jesse Lingard derby didn't end up very well for Forest, did it?
Can I ask you, Nadim, about Danny Ings? Troy said that, look, he smells goals from anywhere. You know, people talk about instinct, you know, this sort of unquantifiable thing that you cannot teach. And I sort of feel that, I must have said that a million times, but is that real? Is that a real thing? Or is that, I mean, obviously Danny Ings practices all the time. Like, but I guess there are centre forwards who practice all the time. And, you know, Neil Mope, I presume, practices, who just can't smell a goal from anywhere.
Wow. I think, I know where you're coming from. And I think it's, every striker will probably practice their finishing. But then the teams and the way they create chances might be a bit different. And I think for Ings, I think he's very, very good at sort of recognising the right spaces to run into. There are some attackers where they just stand in the box and they're the ones who wait for you to sort of look away from them. Then they'll move and they'll put themselves in the right area. They'll make a movement to the left to then go right because they know the cutback's going to come. I think Ings has a real good understanding of where his players are going to be putting the balls into. I think he's consistently been that throughout his career. So I think he does have an instinct for it. I think his teammates know where to play it as well. And say he's one of those strikers where if a ball goes across a 6-yard box, he's going to be like throwing his whole body at it because he senses that's going to be the right place to play the ball. And not every striker has that, but he definitely does. Like they can all finish, but you know, you'd rather have a tap in from 6 yards than say the striker that pulls to 12 to try and send one into the top corner, because that's why we talk about XG, because these chances make a difference.
Yeah. Sort of fair play to the centre forwards who aren't instinctively good at scoring goals, but have yet made a career out of being a centre forward in professional football. That is sort of quite admirable, isn't it? That'll do for part 2. Part 3, begin at Elland Road. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. Leeds 1, Southampton 0. Huge win, Troy, for Javi Gracia there. First win since they beat Bournemouth 4-3 on the 5th of November. They deserved it, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. It's never easy going to somewhere like Leeds, but this was one of those, and I know you'll say to me about every game is a must-win, but this was a must-win game. The battle of the two new gaffers. Leeds are always very bright at their place if they know that they can sniff an opportunity of victory and listen, the goal, wow, the goal. Nadim's probably better describing this than me, but Benterek, I'm not sure what he was doing in front of his keeper and then to decide to almost pull his leg away from a shot that probably should have been comfortably cleared, comfortably saved, one of those where you can actually wait for the ball to come to you before you do one of them dramatic dives in front of you. And it's the difference. It's the difference between, you know, the 3 points that Leeds got and the no points that Southampton got. In the grand scheme of things, you just need to accumulate the points. Something that they've done well at home, and obviously we can't describe away from home. And I think for Garcia, who I'm surprised got the job, I've got to be totally honest. But there you go. It's a long way in. But you know, I don't think it will matter. Yes, the fans on the day would like to know that their team is playing towards a structure and a plan, but just get over the line. And I think that's what Leeds did in this one. They just got over the line, and particularly because Southampton would have gone in full of beans after, you know, their famous win against Chelsea the week before, but they couldn't follow it up. And, you know, the 3 points go to Leeds.
Do you think, Nadim, I mean, that goal is obviously defensively, there are so many times when they could make a challenge or clear it. But do you think with Bednarek, because he scored a hilarious own goal about a week or two ago, he thought, I can't do another one? I mean, I know it's a split second. It's a split second thing. So maybe you don't have time to process it like that.
It's almost like someone just lassoed his feet just as the ball was coming to him. And just, you know what I mean? I don't know. It's one of those ones where you need to ask him, but then like, not surely no one's even enough to ask him what were you thinking? But I don't know. I feel like it's happened a few times this year where people have just glitched. Do you remember the David De Gea goal he conceded where he was just standing on his post as the ball just ricocheted around and went in?
Yeah.
I can't explain it. It's just a horrendous goal as well. Because then after that, maybe Bazunu's had to react late, but I still think he's like dived over the top of it. And they had them Leeds in the corner with nothing going on. Like, what, you're down at the bottom. If you beat Leeds, you go above them. Leeds go to the bottom. Then you concede one of the worst goals you concede throughout the whole season. And nobody can explain how any of it's come to be. I think there's a picture of Ward-Prowse just standing in the distance, just looking at it, thinking like, what has gone on here? You know what I mean? Like, what is life? But yes, it's... He's probably thinking,
have I got to score another free kick to get them out of this?
Yeah, it seems that way. But yeah, I cannot explain that one. But as I say, I'm not evil enough to just reach out to him and ask, like, did your controller just fail to connect for a second? Or like, what happened to you, Paul?
I think if you're someone who doesn't regularly talk to Jan Bednarek, to then get in touch with him, that would be really quite unkind. Mark Bosnick calls those dives a Sydney Harbour Bridge, where you sort of go. It's quite an accurate description. What you really want is a kind of London Bridge, which is just a straight dive, don't you?
Max, do you mind if I ask, Nadim, have you ever had that thought where, you know, I'm going to clear it, oops, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what I'm doing, so I'm just going to leave it to the keeper.
Yeah, I've had that once or twice, yeah. It tends to be those sort of like balls which get put into, you know, that territory between the six-yard box, goalkeeper and all that.
Yeah.
It's like, I've totally got this. No, the keeper's totally got this. And now, oh, no, the striker's got it. We've lost. We've conceded. Ah, right. Never mind. But this is football. This is why we love it. You know what I mean? Clearly, I'm over this.
Michael says, did Everton keep the receipt for Sean Dyche? Can they send him back? I don't know if that's harsh. You know, two wins, two defeats, probably have taken that. But Troy, this wasn't a... I mean, I guess, you know, this is fine margins and like, had things gone the other way, but I thought they looked a bit flat in this game.
They did in the second half. I thought it was a decent end-to-end game in the first half with, you know, when I say decent, the ball got turned over quite a lot. So there's attacks at one end, it gets turned over, there's attacks at the other. Villa were very threatening. I'm going to say I'm... Damari Gray is Everton's top goal scorer. He has been one of the only sparks over the last, obviously, year or so since he's been at the club. And yet he sits on the bench for quite a long time since Sean has come in. I'm not sure if that's because of his results in the bleep test or whatever it may be. I'm surprised that he has spent so long on the bench. If you look at the way, the way Arteta went on Saturday with his Martinelli, Saka, Trossard partnership, I see Gray as potentially being someone who, you know, playing up front would at least stretch the opposition and make them think differently right in front of them. I'm losing my words here because I'm so disappointed at this result, because it was an opportunity to get out of the position they were in. 1 in 17 for a £15 million striker is not good, considering we don't spend money that much. 6 defenders on a bench plus a keeper, so there's not a lot to look at after that, and only 6 goals in the last 11. But Villa were good, you know, particularly after their last result, and their front pairing was very good. And it's ultimately the front pairing, Watkins and McGinn, that were involved in, and Buendia when he came on, who was again exceptional when he came on, that won them the game in two very, very quick moments.
6 defenders and a keeper seems like a brilliant Sean Dyche bench to me. I hope they're all centre-backs. Anyway, Barry.
I really do fear for Everton because you just don't know where the goals are going to come from. You know, you can't rely on Seamus Coleman to whip in worldies every week. I think the other goal they got under Dyche was a Tarkowski header at a corner, was it? But Maupay, you know, Maupay scored in his second appearance for Everton, and that ended, well, at the time, it ended a 12-match barren streak. But with the benefit of hindsight, we now know it just began a 17-match barren streak. And he works hard, but he's awful in front of goal. For a striker, a centre-forward, I mean, that's a terrible return. He should have had a couple on Saturday. Dominic Calvert-Lewin's injured again. Even when he's fit, he wasn't scoring. He's only got one, I think, this season so far. Damari Gray's on the bench. So I just do not know where they're going to get the goals to keep themselves up. And they can't keep clean sheets, which is a worry.
Yeah, and back in the bottom three, they play Arsenal midweek. Then they have games against Chelsea, Spurs and Manchester United coming up in their next five. I mean, that is not an easy run, is it? Palace-Liverpool, Tony says, assume you'll be going big on Palace-Liverpool. Nadim, I know everybody talks about Trent Alexander-Arnold's defending. And I almost feel like stubborn about not wanting to talk about the thing that everyone else is talking about. But it doesn't appear to be very good.
I kind of know where you're coming from here, Max. I think I totally understand. And I think some of the elements of defending is, it's not even like technical. It's just the mentality to do it, just to be aggressive and to really defend well, because he wouldn't be playing for Liverpool if he like physically couldn't defend. But just at times, I just think he's too relaxed about things. In a moment where you need like a huge sense of urgency, he kind of goes missing. And I think for lots of people, they're prepared to offset it because of his amazing attacking potential. But I don't know. It's a fantastic player, but I just want him to just love defending just that little bit more. I'd rather see him high-fiving a centre-back because he made a great tackle sometimes than seeing him, you know, be trying to start the next attack by taking a potential risk. But then again, this is why I'm not a manager, because you'd probably hate my football, because I'd probably have six centre-backs out there. You know what I mean? Just secure it at the back. He's a good player. Like, defensively, he makes mistakes, but everyone does. But because we have a thing about him, we sort of focus on his just that little bit more. And I think in some ways you could argue that's unfair, but then he himself likely doesn't want to watch back some of those instances, but Klopp still trusts him. And for Klopp to still trust him after all these years, I think it just goes to show that, you know, he understands the player better than we do to some extent.
Is it a kind of, I was going to say I hate comparing the Premier League to Sunday League. I love comparing it to it. But, you know, in Sunday League football, it is so much easier to run when you're attacking than when you're defending. It's just easier. It just doesn't, you just feel like, oh, I want to run to get that ball, whereas I don't want to run to track that guy. But like, presumably that can't be the same at the absolute top level of football.
Yes. Yeah, of course it is. That's literally football in a nutshell. Roberto Mancini spoke to Michael Richards and he said, when you're running forward, it's like you're running downhill. And then when you're coming back, it's like you're running uphill to try and get back in. And like, this is exactly what it is, because when you're running forward, you've got the carrot of a goal in there or like a huge involvement. Whereas when you're running back, like, it's only for the real, like, defensive weirdos out there. And unfortunately, I was one of them, who sprints faster going back than you do going forward, because you're desperate to be involved. But most of the people, they'll just leave it to someone else. And the ones you need to look out for the most, Max, is a bit of insight for you.
Yeah.
Are the ones whereby, say there's a break for the opposition and people are running back and then the keeper gets it. Whoever the keeper throws the ball to next, who's on the halfway line, completely free, they're the ones who sacked off defending, but now get the crowd excited. They're the ones you need to keep an eye out for, because you never see them if you concede, but then they're the hope of the whole stadium when the next attack begins. And they, unfortunately, are scumbags.
Jack says, Jurgen Klopp just said on Sky Sports, he learned that a shot that hits the bar isn't on target tonight. Troy is in very good company there. Well done, Troy.
Thank you.
Nobody can see you lifting your hands to the sky. It's an audio, audio medium.
Yeah, I know, but you've just told them that I did, so that they can now visualize me doing that. Thank you, Jurgen. I always had a lot of time for you, and I appreciate your understanding in this time.
The other game on Friday night, Fulham 1, Wolves 1. Kev says, who would win in a joust between Sergio and Sarabia? Smart finish from him. Manuel Solomon got another goal off the bench for Fulham. You sort of feel, Barry, that there's a bit of a missed opportunity here for Fulham. You know, it's unlikely they're going to be in the hunt for Europe every season. And they are. And you shouldn't drop points at home to Wolves.
I don't know. I thought that game had a draw written all over it, to be honest. It duly happened, so I am wise. I think it's a pretty satisfactory result for both teams. I don't think Fulham deserved to win. I don't think they deserved to lose. I thought Manor Solomon, those three goals he's got off the bench, they're all good. And they're all, it's kind of the same goal three times, isn't it? But this was the pick of them. But I wouldn't say it's a particularly bad result for Fulham.
All right, then. In the Scottish League Cup, Celtic beat Rangers 2-1. Chris Sutton tweeted, this isn't a dig, but Michael Beale hasn't won anything yet as a player or a manager. Sounds like a dig, Chris, to me. Barry, you watched this, I believe. And, you know, Furuhashi has been great for Celtic, and he was the match winner.
Yeah, for the second League Cup final in a row, he was on the double, I think. It was a pretty straightforward win for Celtic, to be honest. They went 2-0 up through Furuhashi. Rangers pulled a goal back through Alfredo Morelos. And I have a feeling, and I'm sure I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, but I have a feeling that's the first goal he scored against Celtic. But I could be mistaken. But towards the end, it was all one-way traffic. And that traffic was very much Celtic players converging on the Rangers goal and peppering Alan McGregor. And he had to make a save. Haksabanovic missed two pretty decent chances. Matt O'Reilly missed a chance. So when you would have expected Rangers to be throwing this kitchen sink at Celtic, it was actually the other way around. And it was pretty, like the League Cup final at Wembley, it was pretty straightforward.
Now, just after we finished recording on Thursday, the news reached us that John Motson had passed away at the age of 77. Tributes have been paid to him from across the football world. It's probably fair to say that along with, I'd say, Barry Davis and Brian Moore in TV terms, these guys were the soundtrack. Motty was the soundtrack to every British football fan who's probably between the age of 35 and 60, Troy. I mean, it's sort of those guys who commentated for so long on so many major tournaments. On Match of the Day, you know, they picked out some of Motti's highlights. It's just so many amazing goals that almost by osmosis, he becomes part of your life.
It's the voice you recognise first, isn't it? It's the person that's on the end of the microphone that's coming through your TV screen that excites you about the game, particularly in those major moments. The one I love is the French goal against Portugal in the Euro semi-final, you know. He brought us into that stadium. Platini, last minute, just the excitement of the kind of play, you know, the build-up play and the ball in the back of the net. That kind of stuff. So when a commentator can send chills down your spine as if you wish you were there, that's the mark of a person. And he'd done it on quite a number of occasions.
Yeah, he was, my experience of him was, I mean, like a football obsessive. You know, football, I think Lineker said on Match of the Day, that was his subject, you know, and he was like 100% football. And I don't know, Nadim, if you sort of think, it's when you think about these, you know, people that you've heard for so long, I suspect part of it is you sort of think about your own mortality or you just think about your own aging as part of this idea of this person that has just been sort of there, just an ever-present. No, and Barry made a good point as well. So when we were growing up, like there wasn't actually that much football on the telly, right? So everybody was hearing the same voice and watching the same game.
Yeah, for sure. I think he's one of those, or he's one of those people that sort of unites people who love the game of football. I think you mentioned before 35 to 60 something, but I think anyone who loves football, who likes the history of football, who watches back in terms of how World Cups were won, FA Cup finals, you know, the Ronnie Radford one, like that's his voice. You've heard it before, but you might not know who he is. If you're old, you know who he is, but you recognize that voice. And that, like, as I say, it unites us all. And it's so sad that he's passed. But then what a run he had. I think he was born in 1945. You know, it's incredible. And the fact that he was such a big deal to a game that we love so much. And as you mentioned, it's not a monopoly as such. But today, if you wanted to watch the highlights of the game of the cup final yesterday, you could see them across many platforms. And hear different voices, probably have it on mute because there's a lot of nonsense to get spoken about these days. But with John, like that's his voice, you know, whether he's shouting Beckham, whether he's shouting Radford, where it's like, Tigana, Tigana. You know, these are iconic moments in football history, which he was a big part of, trusted to be there for. and people love them. He's one of the big reasons why we love the game of football, because, you know, it's one thing seeing it, but as Troy was saying, to almost get the goosebumps because of the way they describe it, like, that's a job done very, very well. And most of us wouldn't be involved in the game today if some of that love didn't come from some of those moments which he covered himself.
This is on a slightly different subject from a friend of the pod, Joachim, saying, looking at this, what is the worst thing you've ever seen printed on a shirt? Yes, it's somebody who's in full Aston Villa kit with Stag Bon Lahore 69. It's the end of days. Yep. That is the end of days, isn't it? I mean, presumably, I mean, what we don't know is, did he like that? But, you know, if it was like ultra ironic, like if Barry had a stag do and I got him that, like, he would be so angry, it would almost be worth it. But I don't think I could. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of agony.
I think the chances of me having a stag do at this stage are pretty slim.
David says, is Nadim happy with the photo BBC Sport chose for him for his contributions on their live text feed? He looks well pissed off in it.
Interestingly, I've not seen that one, but I can tell you a story about that. There was another show. I was doing like the FA Cup highlight show one time, and then they were doing a trail for something, and there was a picture of me, Troy Deeney, and someone else that was going to be coming on a show. And they put my head on, I think, Dion Dublin's body, but my head was too small. My shoulders were really wide. And it was really surreal, because I was thinking, I've never taken a picture with the BBC. How have they got this? Then I looked. I was like, oh, my God. The absolute state of me here. I've been done in. Someone in the back's tried to do a good job. It was a disgrace. It was an absolute disgrace. So, yeah, I expect nothing but bad pictures of me on the internet anyway. So I get over it now. But, yeah, what a moment that was.
Finally, Chris says, hi, Max, Barry and the gang. Your podcast is simply quite brilliant. Thank you so much. Over the years, I've grown to feel like listening to it is like checking in with a bunch of mates down the pub. Well, in a few weeks, I'm hoping those mates will help me get through a bit of a challenge I'm undertaking. I'll be running a marathon at the North Pole in the 18th edition of the North Pole Marathon. It could be as cold as minus 50. Blimey. And my plan is to keep 4 to 5 of the pods unlistened to, have us company as while I run around the ice. It will undoubtedly be the hardest thing I've ever done. I'm hoping your company will keep me going. I'm running it to support a local autism charity. My 6-year-old was diagnosed on the autism spectrum aged 4. Any help you could give in promoting my fundraising would be hugely appreciated. I'm running the North Pole Marathon in support of Cheshire Autism. There's a GoFundMe page. I'll tweet it out and get everyone to retweet it. Thank you for everything you do and the joy your show brings to so many people. You won't be saying that at mile 18. will you? For a long-suffering and now optimistic Manchester United fan, Chris will know. Barry, would you like to wish Chris the best of luck to run the North Pole Marathon?
Well, I'm guessing if he's keeping these stored up, he may not hear this until he's actually running the marathon and almost certainly regretting his decision to take on this monumental ordeal. And I wish him all the very best, and I'd rather him than me. And good luck to him.
Good luck, Chris. I think it's good that the pod has reached the North Pole. I'd be very interested, you know, if you do listen and you're sort of in a remote part of the world, that would be it'd be great if you could get in touch. footballweekly@theguardian.com. producer Joel suggests a North Pole live show. I mean, it's ambitious, but you know, give it a go.
Darrow Breen did a stand-up gig in some really remote, far-flung outpost quite recently. I can't remember where exactly, but it's one of those places where it's like dark, more or less 24 hours a day.
Oh, right.
And yeah, everyone was walking around dressed like the Michelin Man. But if you are in a remote spot, get in touch.
Yeah, it could be your stag do, couldn't it? A Michelin Man. Stag Bon Lahore 69, everything comes together. Anyway, look, that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nadim.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Troy.
Pleasure, Max.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.